Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
Thank you very much. Thank you. It's such an honour to be here, and thank you for everybody who persevered through the rain to get here this evening. So this is called Pacini and the Ghosts of Rome. There are many ways in which an opera lover might first have encountered the great Pacini, the centenary of whose passing has been marked this year. My own introduction was unusual, involving three factors that feature in his immortal work La Bohème: youthfulness, alcohol, and pain. One summer, 30 years ago, I travelled over from London, where I lived at the time, to stay at the Tyrone Guthrie Centre for Writers and Artists in Annamacarrick. It's a hospitable place. Someone opened wine at dinner. Alas, someone opened whiskey for dessert. The night became woozy, running late and long. By midnight, we were all in a somewhat literary condition. It didn't stop there. The roistering lasted until dawn. As the rosy fingers of the sun arose over Monaghan's drumlins, someone suggested a game of football. Football played by athletic people is a beautiful game. Played by out-of-condition poets and drunken novelists, not so much. Like elephants trying to play tiddlywinks. At a crucial moment, to interrupt a pass from an inebriated essayist, I ran, stretching out a leg for the wet, spinning ball, and as I tumbled, uttering profanities, I felt something break. The doctor at Monaghan Hospital examined the x-ray and confirmed I had broken my foot in two places. As the nurse applied the plaster cast, she asked a pertinent question: had I not better things to be doing with my life than acting the Aegis? On crutches, I felt I couldn't face the flight and the return to London, so I went to stay a few weeks with my dad and stepmom back in Dublin. One morning, my father, Sean, came ambling through the kitchen, lilting a tune. He was, still is, a beautiful singer, and we were all used to him singing as he went about the house. If a string quartet by Boccherini came on the radio, Sean would pause and conduct the furniture. He had a special and lasting affection for the bel canto operas, but this was a tune I hadn't heard before. I asked what it was. It was Quando Men Vo, sometimes known as Musetta's Waltz from Puccini's La Bohème. Then he invited me into the living room, where he played a CD of another aria by the great man, a Luca van le Stelle from Tosca, sung by the majestic Jussi Björling. At the time, opera was not my thing. I knew nothing about it. I was leather of jacket and skin tight of trouser. Music involved electric guitars and unwise haircuts. But there was something haunting about these beautiful melodies by Pacini, so delicate and full of feeling and life. It happened that the following week, there was an evening of operatic music at the National Concert Hall. Sean and I went, he striding in confidently to his favourite seat, I limping along behind him on the crutches. Not long into the evening, Si Mi Chiama Mimi was performed. I was smitten. She had broken her heart. I had broken my foot. But still, I knew how she felt. Not long afterwards, Quando Men Vo was sung. And I'll never forget the experience of hearing it live for the first time in the National Concert Hall. In the spring of 1899, Pacini came to Rome on a quest that only Rome could fulfill. To a Roman, spring is lovely, the soprano of the seasons. Gracious parks, glorious gardens shake awake and don their flirtish finery. Pink azaleas, scarlet poppies, yellow and gold mimosa. old churches glimpsed through blossom, sunlight through stained glass, warmer, richer light gilding frescoes and fountains, dawn rising earlier on a blushing Colosseum, Chianti-tinted apartment blocks and cream-hued cathedrals. But that was not the Rome Pacini sought. The dark, tragic opera he was working on was set in the Eternal City, and he wanted to listen to Rome's bells. Day after day, he sat alone in the vastness of St. Peter's Square, listening to peals and gongs, chimes and booms. I've spent a lot of time in Rome in recent years, writing a trilogy of novels set there, so the bells make a music I know well. One evening, as I walked through St. Peter's Square on a foggy night, I thought of him sitting there alone. In a city of ghosts, he must have looked like a lonesome ghost himself, a silhouette haunted by bell song. No operatic composer ever had a better sense of place. The chiaroscuro Rome of Tosca, of shadows and danger, of political intrigue and secret police. The Paris of Bohemians, of the young urban poor, where homelessness and illness are constant spectres, but joy may be found in friendship and music. When Musetta sings on Christmas Eve, the world comes into colour for a fleeting, fragile moment, and the cares of the world are put down. Here, on the stage from which the gift first came pouring, I salute the noble shade of Maestro Puccini, the music that rings bells in the dusk of the heart.
Is. Couples at Christmas time. For the first row of Christmas, says he to me, just where will we put this real Christmas tree? For the second row of Christmas, says me to he, can Santa manage our kids' list of Noel glee? For the third row of Christmas, says he to me, do we have to have a mad shopping spree? For the fourth row of Christmas, says me to he, our gaff needs a serious clean, that's my plea. For the fifth row of Christmas, says he to me, is drinks with the lads even a possibility? For the sixth row of Christmas, says me to he, let's invite all the neighbours in for Yuletide tea. For the last row of Christmas, says he to me, forget this perfect holiday malarkey. For the eighth kiss of Christmas, says me to he, let's give and help the homeless find a home key. For the ninth kiss of Christmas, says he to me, we'll holly your folks' graves with love's decree. For the tenth kiss of Christmas, says me to he, We'll do Christmas dinner with yours in the country. For the 11th kiss of Christmas, says he to me, we'll bring trifle and a roasted turkey. For the 12th kiss of Christmas, says me to he, here's mistletoe. Let me sit on your knee. I'd just like to say Merry Christmas to me fella, and sorry about that. Merry Christmas, everybody.
Thank you so much. It's really lovely to be here with you all. I would like to share a Yuletide poem which draws on a ritual of oak and mistletoe, which was practiced by Druids long ago. Mistletoe was considered a rare and sacred plant among the Druids. The ceremony was carried out on the sixth day following the new moon, where the priest would climb an oak tree and cut down the mistletoe with a golden sickle. It was then caught in a white cloak. The mistletoe was used to prepare a life-giving elixir that they believed was an antidote to all poisons. There is also a reference to capnomancy, which is an ancient practice of divination by smoke. During the winter solstice, Druids would burn the leaves and branches of oak and mistletoe and interpret the patterns and movement of the smoke. The smoke became the storyteller. This is a sort of spell, and it is titled Charm of the Capnomancer. In oaken grove, besieged by snow, calico cloaked with two white bulls, on branch entranced by mistletoe, one-seeded pearls, unsullied roots. In month of birch, on long night moon, by seventh tree and sixth of night, at turn of yule, forked twigs fresh hewn, from flame sung dark with golden scythe. Smudged wisps unfurl like herald wings, uncanny plumes drift through the trees. 100 grasses, 10,000 things, wild smoke divines its own stories. From gods we thieved this element. Come, steal away with me again. Thank you.
Thank you. I've never told a single soul about how I came to almost cut off the tops of two fingers 4 days before Christmas in 1982, so we might agree to just keep this story to ourselves. I was trying to open a stubborn jam jar lid, and I remembered seeing someone on television do something similar by violently stabbing the top of the lid with a sharpened knife to release the pressure underneath. Unfortunately, the sharpest knife we had in the house was for spreading butter. And I had especially puny arms for a child of my age. So all I succeeded in doing was putting a dent in the lid and, crucially, shattering the glass at the neck of the jar so that when it twisted off, very easily as it happened, the broken glass underneath sliced through the tops of two of my fingers. As I sat with my mother in A&E in Loughlinstown Hospital, blood seeping through a makeshift bandage, I downplayed my role in the affair, telling her that the thing just mysteriously broke in my hand. When the doctor had stitched up my fingers, we went home, and my mother took out the good Basildon Bond notepaper to write a stiff letter of complaint. To the jam company. I wondered aloud whether I'd sustained the kind of injury for which compensation might be paid. My mother said that that would be blood money, which was perfectly fine by me. I had bled after all. But she said money earned that way is money that would bring no luck. You might as well give it to the neighbours, she said. She was writing to the jam company, she explained, because she didn't want this happening to someone else's child. I ate my Christmas dinner that week with two comic-sized bandages swaddling my fingers. The year turned, and we waited to hear back from the jam company through January, February, and March. There was no reply. April came and went, so did May. That summer, the world went Star Wars mad, and no one more so than me. The third film in the series, The Return of the Jedi, was released, and the shops were suddenly filled with toys that I wanted like I wanted my next breath. Dozens of new figures, Admiral Akbar, Bib Fortuna, Nien Num, Grimorian guards, biker scouts, and about 20 different Ewoks. Then there were spaceships, there were speeder bikes, scout walkers, Tatooine skiffs, and frustratingly, I couldn't afford any of them. By an extraordinary coincidence, it was around that time that I started to experience terrible shooting pains in the two fingers that had been horribly disfigured by the gross, some would say criminal negligence, of what I now refer to as Big Jam. I told my mother about it at breakfast one morning. She insisted on taking me to the local GP, who said I may have sustained some kind of nerve damage in my fingers that was only presenting now. Encouraged by this, I upped the ante. Pains that woke me in the middle of the night, pains that stopped me from holding a pen, pains that made me want to chew off my hand at the wrist. At one point, I even developed a limp, but decided I was possibly over-egging it and quickly dropped it from the overall act. But it had the desired effect because the good Basildon Bond notepaper was out again and a second letter was written, this one even stiffer than the first. A week or two later, at the start of December, the jam company wrote back to say, "Sweet baby Jesus, they were sending a man to the house." That was the Christmas that Darth Vader came to Ballybrack Shopping Centre. I remember being crammed along with hundreds of other kids into Tesco Home and Wear, and the excitement as the lights went out and the Imperial March struck up as the Dark Lord of the Sith appeared through a doorway between the power tools and the potting compost. Word had got around Cromlech Fields that my ship would soon be coming in. And I swaggered around the estate promising everyone BMXs and rally burners like a modern-day Jay Gatsby. The day arrived. A car pulled up outside the house. A man got out wearing, of all things, a shirt and tie. The only time we ever saw men in shirts and ties was when the Jehovah's Witnesses were going door to door and entire families were forced to hide behind the settee until they were gone. He knocked on the letterbox and I had to restrain myself from shouting, "Santa's here." We were sent to our bedrooms while my mother talked to the man. I wasn't allowed to offer medical testimony, even though the pains in my fingers had worsened considerably in the last few days. I lay on the floor with my ear to the carpet, straining to hear the conversation in the kitchen below. My brother Mark asked me how much I thought I'd get. With all the promises I made, I reckon I was going to need about £5,000. Which, as it happened, I thought was just about fair compensation for the pain and mental trauma I'd suffered. After 20 minutes, the man from Big Jam was saying goodbye. I heard him apologizing profusely. Then he left. And the only pain I felt in that moment were cramps of excitement, waiting to find out how much money I was going to get. I threw open the bedroom door and raced across the landing. And my heart sank when I saw my mother standing downstairs in the hallway holding, not a check, but a small tray of jams and marmalades. I knew in that instant that she'd sold my dreams for a mess of pottage, or more precisely, 12 pots of pottage. I walked down the stairs saying, "What in the name of God have you done?" And she said, "Put your shoes on, Paul, then go and give these to the neighbors." Thank you.
I'm the one who's been selected to send you all home to your beds. Our postman hated sudden noises. For a big man, on the morning he delivered the parcel to our front door, he seemed balletic when he swung his right leg over the saddle and dismounted in one smooth, rolling movement. To me, that parcel seemed huge. My grandmother ushered him to the fire so as to thaw out. She knew our house was at the end of his route, and today represented the last delivery before Christmas. The tea she offered was generously laced with whiskey, and the postman smacked his lips as he drank. While she sifted for gossip, I examined the parcel. It was covered in strong brown paper, tied with string, and decked out with an array of stamps, customs declarations, and a return address. My aunts had emigrated to England. In times of war, they married men who had fought. They proudly sent home photos of husbands wearing uniforms and medals. Some of these men had unusual surnames, names that through marriage were taken by my aunts, names you'd never encounter in rural Kilkenny. There was a Seabrook, and to top it all, a Puddiphat, P-U-D-D-I-P-H-A-T-T. The return address on today's parcel was that of my Aunt Molly, now Mrs. Puddiphat, a gentle lady who doted as much on her Dachshunds as she did on her husband, a man who we were to discover made straw hats for a living. I noticed that the postman had nodded off. My grandmother, unaware of earlier hospitality, signalled to be quiet and let him sleep. When a log collapsed in the fireplace, creating an explosive shower of sparks, he sprang awake, clapped both hands to his head, and seemed relieved to find he was wearing a postman's hat and not a metal helmet. You see, he too was an ex-soldier, a man who not only carried a post bag, but also the trauma of war. Unusual for our locality, his house was decorated with a name. The letters Y-P-R-E-S, Eep, were burnt onto a lath of wood and screwed to his front door. His neighbours pronounced it wipers. When he'd departed, I urged my grandmother to open the parcel. The string was knotted and fixed in place using red sealing wax. I handed her the big scissors, but she was not to be rushed. She teased and unpicked each knot with all the concentration of a safe cracker. The brown paper was folded and stowed together with the salvaged string. That paper would cover my school books the following year, still bearing British customs stamps. The Puddiphats sent clothes, chocolates, tins of biscuits, and appropriate to the sender's name, a fat Christmas pudding. An oval-shaped package was addressed to me. That's not to be opened until tomorrow, she said. I felt it, shook it, checked its weight in my hand. Too small to be the cowboy outfit I wanted so badly. I just have to wait. On that Christmas Eve night, excitement robbed me of sleep. I remember lying there impatiently following the track of moonlight as it inched along the wall opposite my bed. The house settled its bulk and creaked an occasional sigh. Passing cars crunched the face of frozen puddles and rearranged the reflection of a splintered moon beneath their tires. I believe I would have drifted off had the bells not summoned me. They seemed to reach to me through the window. They drew me shivering to the drawn blinds and made me inscribe a circle of melting breath upon the frosted flowers of the windowpane. I looked upwards at the glittering field of stars and knew this was a night unlike any other. Stars elbowed and crowded one another's brilliance. The bells of the big chapel intoned in long peals that twisted themselves through the townlands, that hurled over hedges with such clamour they awakened the sleeping dogs. And on this holy of holy nights, when animals are said to be given the power of human speech, it caused them to lift their muzzles to the heavens as they attempted to shepherd stars into new patterns. The scattering bell notes dropped slowly and sweetly as snowflakes, and I hoped they were not interrupting the postman's sleep. There was a silvery splash of stardust above my head, and the moon was a cracked mirror, wafer white as a communion host. It was as if the sky had spread itself wide above the earth and laid out its goodness upon a fold of velvet to display the glory of its gifts. My gift from the Puddiphats the next morning was not the coveted cowboy outfit, but an oval box of dried dates. The fruit arranged in glistening rows. There was even a little plastic two-pronged fork with which to extract them. On the box lid were three wise men on camels, following, I believed, one of those stars that had so recently mesmerized me. The dates and the putafats are long gone, but I still carry the light of that night inside me when the moon looked down on frozen fields, Christmas bells blasted out their message of joy, and the stars spelled out the most wondrous tale of all for a shivering boy, tired but too astonished to sleep. Thank you.
And that was part one of the Christmas Miscellany concert recorded earlier this month at the National Concert Hall with the RTE Concert Orchestra conducted by Stephen Bell. The scripts were Puccini and the Ghosts of Rome by Joseph O'Connor. Couples at Christmas was by Rachel Hegarty. Charm of the Capnomancer by Niddy Zak, Aria Eep. Two Fingers by Paul Howard. And Christmas Dates was by Joe Carney. The music, all performed by the RTE Concert Orchestra conducted by Stephen Bell, was Quando Menvo, or Musetta's Waltz from Puccini's La Bohème, sung by Mary McCabe. Let It Snow by Jules Stein, arranged by Charles Serre. Carol of the Bells by Mykola Leontovich, arranged by Gavin Murphy. Imperial March by John Williams from Star Wars. And Joy to the World by Handel, Lowell Mason and Isaac Watts. This arrangement for orchestra was by Brian Byrne, and the singer was, again, soprano Mary McCabe. And there's going to be more from this concert on Christmas Miscellany. That's this Christmas morning, just after the 9 a.m. news. And the guests will include John Toll, Donald Fallon, Maggie Armstrong and Coitra Reardon. On sound, Pather Carney and James Feeney. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon and the producer is Sarah Binchy.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.